Welcome to the Future of Medicine podcast. My name is Dr. Aaron Wenzel, and my hope is simple, that this show helps you along your journey to become the healthiest, strongest, and most vibrant version of you. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Brentwood MD is located in Nashville, Tennessee, and provides best-in-class concierge primary care. Learn more about our innovative approach to primary care at brentwoodmd.com. Now, let's explore the future of medicine. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the Future of Medicine podcast. Before this episode, I wanted to give another short discussion on context. This is part three of a three-part series from a talk I did in Dallas a couple months ago regarding longevity. This specific episode, I'm really excited to share with you. It's where I dive into a term that I use with my members called health multipliers. You know, what activities can you spend one unit of energy in and get some number greater than one unit of result out, specifically around sleep, diet, exercise. There's a handful of other topics that we cover. And then we go into a Q&A, which I think you'll find really useful, where I field a handful of questions from a very sophisticated crowd. And these questions I find I'm answering in real time in my practice on a day-to-day basis with my members. So in the end, I hope this is all really useful to you. Let's jump right in.
So we cover nutrition. There are a lot of fads and products out there. I thank Instagram and Amazon for delivering it to me. But there are red light saunas, cold plunges. A lot of people wear Whoop devices, Oura Ring. Some have an 8 Sleep. What are some over-the-counter daily habits and products that you subscribe to?
Although imperfect, I think another health multiplier is sleep. Sleep has probably become number one for me, and I know I'm biased because I'm attributing my current health situation to a lack of sleep, and we're all vulnerable to our own biases. But I just don't know how something we do, we spend one third of our entire existence on this planet asleep. I'm just not quite sure how anything else, area under the curve, could even come close. Throw into the mix that a lot of what happens when we're sleeping is a mystery. Like, we don't really know what's going on. We just know we need it. There's some hormonal stuff. There's some memory making and clearing out the hard drive. And we know a little bit about a lot, but it's a universe we don't understand. I think I like the Oura Ring personally. I would say Oura Ring and Whoop are the superior sleep products as I understand the technology in terms of reliability. I just don't like wearing things on my wrist to sleep. It's disruptive to me. And so Apple has some interesting new technologies, but I just don't think it's as good. I use my Apple Watch to track fitness. But Oura or Whoop I like for fitness and sleep. And I think tracking sleep and fitness, there's a dark side for the data maniacal, obsessive people in the room. It could be death by data, and it can be really counterproductive. But I haven't found, a lot of what I do is coaching, and I end up becoming kind of people's coach and helping them think about their thinking. And I just haven't found a more reliable way to change behavior than near immediate feedback. I have an 11-year-old who loves baseball. It's like his oxygen, and he's with a hitting coach right now. And it is amazing to watch his brain respond to his coach. No, it's here, it's hands. And it's that feedback right away that he can apply in his nervous system immediately. There is something about waking up and seeing your data. That's hard to ignore. It's not somebody yapping at you. It's not a judgment thing. It's just the data. Oh, I wonder. It tends to provoke more curiosity than a feeling of being judged. Like, oh, I wonder what I did last night. Oh, I did eat late. I did have a couple extra glasses of wine as everybody went to bed. I wonder if I changed that. This playful, curious gamification that on average tends to be really positive, especially if you have a total blind spot. So something to track your fitness, something to track your sleep, and I tend to like the Oura and the Whoop the best for those. You mentioned some other things.
Sleep 8, cold plunge, red light sauna. I touched a nerve.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
That settles it.
Yeah, I yap a lot, I rant a lot, but I really only talk about like 9 things. And I also would say it depends on where you're saying, is there benefit short-term or long-term? Short-term, I think ice plunging is wildly fascinating. And there's clearly some like short-term benefit. It turns your nervous system on. Like, I'm not convinced there's any long-term benefit. I could be totally wrong. Sauna, maybe less short-term benefit, potentially more long-term benefit. I'm still unsettled on those, and that's why I don't talk a lot about them. My instincts say heat therapy as a warm-blooded creature is probably more long-term beneficial than submitting my body into sub-freezing temperatures. It may be paradoxical. There are a lot of things in science that are paradoxical, but that doesn't feel correct to me, but I don't know. And I don't recommend people do it unless they want to, and they do it and they feel good. If they want to and they don't feel good and they say, what should I do? I say, stop. I don't know. But I heard it was good. But you don't feel good. So like, I got to manage both. I'm trying to manage the long term, don't die, but also short term, I hope you feel really good. And like, you kind of need both, or at least I need the evidence to suggest that the benefit is worth the cost. So that's those two. I don't know.
So you touched upon, there's such a parallel between health and wealth. It's really two of the most important things in people's lives, but you touched upon it in the sense that you're finding people's blind spots. We do that on our side. We advocate for them, and we think about things as they're out there building a business, right? And so it's also parallel because good decisions today play out years and decades down the line. So talk to me about some changes that you can make, that everybody here can make today, that will play out years and decades down the line.
Investing, defined as time, attention, resources, ideally all of those. Not in an obsessive way, but with an intentionality to improve. If 5 to 10% of your discretionary attention every day is not on your health, I'd encourage you to audit that. I think that there's a real opportunity here with not game-changing, life-changing, massive shifts where you could really change the arc of your curve in terms of quality of life and length of life, that area under the curve. I just think it's, but again, this is back to belief systems. You have to believe it's possible. You have to believe it's worth it. If you do, I would say 5 to 10% of your attention shouldn't be enough to disrupt anything else you have going on that's essential, like family and business, charities. Like selfishly in the micro, you have to matter the most. Otherwise, macro, there's a limit to how selfless you can be macro. This is especially for really, 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 really philanthropic kind of people who feel a big burden to improve the world. One of the things I find myself repeating is, yeah, that's awesome, except you're sick. And like, you're punting your own health. It's a bit of a martyrish kind of like, don't be afraid to make yourself priority in the micro every day so that the other 97% of your day you can give to the world. And I think what you'll find over time is that will pay incredible dividends in terms of quality of life and impact. And one more thing, nobody rallies, just while I'm speaking about this, because if you might be thinking, well, yeah, I'll do that like next year. I understand how seductive the thinking is, but like, it just doesn't happen. Like at scale, laws of averages, this will go and we'll push it. It'll continue to get punted until something scary or the threat of something scary will happen. The time to do it is before you have to, just like it's the time to invest, right? It's compound interest works for you and against you. And it's always at play. It's just, are we harnessing it for us or is it working against us? And it works economically, it works in purpose, it works in health. And so the things that I coach people to do are quite boring, actually. But they matter over time, which is why focusing on keeping the main thing, these health multipliers, strength training, sleep, what am I putting in my body? What are my chemistries? Do I have blind spots with cancer? Do I have blind spots with heart? Okay, cool. Like and then keeping tabs on that with some sort of rhythm in an environment where you have advocacy and true relationship is the best path I know.
And stop smoking.
And definitely stop smoking.
So what, look, it's an ever-changing pace of healthcare. I mean, on the investment side, we are making investments today that didn't exist 10 years ago. What do you no longer believe that you once thought as just true? Like, this is, you know, butter's bad, now it's okay. And cholesterol can be high, but now it can be a little bit lower. What do you believe now?
If we had more time, I would tell you how much I love that question. not because it doesn't put me in an awkward situation, because it does. But as I try to be a critical thinker. And one of the things to be a critical thinker that I try to practice often is, what truths do I hold that are no longer true? And it takes an incredible amount of intellectual humility, which is something that I crave kind of just personally in my relationships with other people. Because I don't know what I don't know. They're called blind spots, and I don't have the market cornered on truth. I would say, I used to think that sleep didn't matter kind of at all. And I was surrounded by a bunch of high achievers who were that way. And like, it was almost really, really unhealthy confirmation bias around, oh, I was up all night studying or whatever. Like, oh, you have to sleep, you're weak. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. In the world of academia, before I figured out how to get good grades, I sucked at school, so I had to go to the army and I took the road less traveled. But even in the military, it was very much like, how hardcore are you? And so sleep was always something that like, you were willing to cut. I find culturally, oh, kids got youth group, they got sports, they got homework. Oh, just stay up. You'll rally in the morning. Like culturally, like we just tend to punt sleep really early. And we teach our kids like, it's not all that important. Like, in a pinch, get a little less sleep. And it's convicting because I did it for myself and I was guilty up until recently of doing that even with my own kids. Like, come on, dude. Rally. What's wrong with you?
It's a cultural thing, right? I think so.
And then if you are in an environment that really enhances it, like high performers tend to like burn the candle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that would be the big one. The other one would be around diet. I was trained, and there are a lot of people in this room who probably still subscribe to this. So I'm running the risk of kind of like challenging some belief systems here, but that's okay. That weight management was a math problem, that it's about calories in and calories out. I really held firmly to that dogma. What I now believe is that while calories absolutely matter, and they are a part of the equation, they certainly are the most important thing before you have metabolic disease, before there's energy dysregulation. It's primarily math, like expenditure, consumption, money coming in, money going out. It's very similar. But once your metabolic engines and inefficiencies start to creep up, you have hormonal imbalances, your nervous system starts going out, it's far more biochemistry than math. In the setting of metabolic inefficiency, it's more biochemistry than math. If you're metabolically healthy, it probably is still mostly calories. That would be the other big one.
All right, we're going to open it up, but I want to do a speed round because we're going to cover a number of topics.
Okay.
So quick hits. So GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic, first they were diabetes drug, then they're a weight loss drug, and now there's talk of them being cardiovascular maintenance. Go.
All drugs have downside. There is no such thing as a benign drug. Tylenol will kill you. It's a toxin, but it's dose-dependent poison. With that said, I am on record saying I think the GLP-1 agonist class are the most significant pharmacologic breakthrough since penicillin. That is my personal preference. I could be proven to be totally wrong. Given the fact that metabolic disease is burning societies to the ground, it is absolutely behind cardiovascular disease, cancer. We are probably a few years away from Alzheimer's dementia being renamed diabetes type 3. It's probably insulin resistance at the brain. Probably. These GLP-1 agonists, we have never had a tool in a tool shed that attacks the root cause quite like this. It is unbelievable. Do they have a dark side? Of course. Does everything get misused? Of course. Can it be abused? Of course. Lots of bad things happen when you stop eating. Like, and anybody who's ever taken it or knows somebody who's like, it's just nothing there. That has to be managed. Primarily protein intake, secondarily micronutrient supplementation. I think the risk can be managed if you're in the right relationship. I'm very bullish on them.
Bullish as a cardiovascular maintenance?
Yes. Mostly because the primary driver of cardiovascular disease, it's a multifactorial disease. And I'm going to talk a little bit of shop here, and I don't mean to talk over you, but in the world of risk stratification, when we say, what is somebody's future cardiovascular risk? We use language that is interesting. But what we will say with diabetes is it's a cardiovascular risk equivalent. In English, what that means is if you have diabetes but never had heart disease, you have the exact same risk of a cardiovascular incident as somebody with known heart disease. It is the gateway physiology to atherosclerosis and plaque formation. And this is why all diabetics end up with heart disease, 100%.
He said all diabetics wind up with a heart attack?
No, with heart disease, with atherosclerosis, yes. And the greatest thing for a diabetic to do to lower their risk of a heart attack or a cardiovascular incident would be to normalize their blood glucose and normalize their insulin, ideally. The challenge becomes most diabetics, if you become diabetic long enough, you end up on insulin, which helps with the blood sugar management, but it's devastating to the arterial lining of your coronaries. This hyperinsulin state creates something called metabolic syndrome, truncal obesity, triglycerides through the roof, blood pressure, truncal obesity, visceral fat. This is where I'm saying it's more biochemistry than math by the time metabolic disease is at play. Oh, another belief system I have. I'll backtrack just a little bit.
Moderator's privilege. Go ahead.
If you have diabetes or you're told you're a borderline, unless it's super, super, super far advanced, even if it is, it's improvable. It's wildly improvable. And if it's mild or moderate, I have plenty of case studies where we have people totally normalized A1Cs, totally off insulin, and completely normalized their metabolic engines. It takes a ton of work, but it's achievable, just so you know.
Supplements, yay or nay?
I want to say yay, but I don't know. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. Most of them create very expensive urine. Anybody who's taking vitamins and your urine glows, it's like... most recently, I have a guy, he's paying like $10,000 a month for these really super fancy vitamins from some other person. And it makes his urine seriously look like antifreeze. I don't know if anybody's worked on a car as a kid, but it's like this neon bluey frothy. I'm like, hey, this is not approved. And he's like, no, I'm doing it. I feel better. I'm like, okay. Not approved. The problem is I don't know how to properly vet where vitamin companies are sourcing their products. It's a very, like to send a sample of a product you want to see, like is it actually what it says it is? It's about $5,000 to $7,000 per sample to send to a third party. It's just not achievable. There are a few brands who stand out to me personally that I think they do. I think they do a good job of sourcing really high quality. It does seem with soil deprivation and the way we're eating highly processed foods, especially if you're on a GLP-1, we need micronutrients. I mean, because you're just not eating. It does make sense to have a thoughtful micronutrient supplementation plan. I just don't know. I'm not anti and I'm not pro. It feels like it should be a part of it. I just haven't found the right path to have high confidence that people are taking what it actually says they're taking. That's been hard for me to, I think it's elusive on purpose. I mean, anybody can have a vitamin line. You can just decide you want to sling vitamins, open an Amazon shop, and you're selling vitamins. Like, not sure.
So Last one, then we're going to open up to the audience. Okay, this good. Is not political, but remember, you are in Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
It's timely. RFK Jr. making a lot of waves as Health and Human Services Secretary, potentially. Thoughts?
I'm interested to see how it shakes out. I think it's a new voice, and I like his... What I'm drawn to with him, I don't know him, and I don't know much about him, full transparency. But I'm interested in people who display courage, and there's an element about him that doesn't feel political, and it feels very courageous. And he has a deep, deep heart for fixing health in our kids. And I think no matter where you stand, I think having healthier children is something we all can agree. Childhood obesity rates are skyrocketing. And it's largely how we're feeding our children. I mean, it is criminal the way underfunded schools are feeding their children who don't have means. I mean, it is... We have 9-year-olds with fully raging adult onset diabetes and metabolic disease. I've also been on record of saying pediatricians, by the time I'm done practicing, will have to learn how to manage heart attacks, acute coronary syndrome. It's going to happen. Heart attacks used to be a disease of 60-year-old smoking men, like for all of time. We are now seeing women in their late 20s. In my ER work, we're doing an acute cardiac arrest. Like she's having a heart attack right now. That's been brewing for 10, 15 years. And the primary contributor to that is diet. This is why I'm so bullish on the GLP-1s if people have access to. I mean, obviously the downsides need to be managed. And there's a huge element of the unknown. It's so new that there is an element. We need long-term data. And, it could create a third leg. I don't know. That would be a problem.
All right, so I lied. And we didn't prep for this, so this is a let's leave us with a dose of optimism.
Yeah.
We've talked about some... My dog died when I was younger. We can talk about that next. But,
That's sad.
Yeah, I know. We've talked about a lot of things that are real. But give me a dose of optimism, whether it be about healthcare in general or medicine, or give me some optimism.
The optimism is... Most of what I was just ranting about is avoidable. It totally is. And even if you're in it, it's fixable. Like, the good news is we have tools, we have insight, and I think I have a playbook for someone to find the person with your own advocacy driving the bus. This largely can be improved, and it matters so much. Because when you look at the decline as people age, the average person kind of has the average experience. It's very predictable. That's because we all have the same diseases, because we're all eating, we're all doing the same thing. Like, and to get breakthrough, something has to break. Like, and I just think, for proper context, we need to know the scary stuff. But outside of the scary stuff, it's all upside. Like, getting cancer is super scary. Like, but I can promise you, as somebody who's seen thousands of deaths, probably hundreds of ways to die, I can assure you that every one of those people who were not at peace and pain-free and ready to die, if they could have gone back in time and changed something to invest it, they would. If I would have just known a little earlier, or I would have just... Uh-huh. This should be incredibly, like, I feel like in order to be enlightened and see things, there's an element of ripping the Band-Aid off that has to happen. But once the Band-Aid's off, it's like, let's go to work. I mean, this is so improvable. And actually, you don't need to improve 27 things. This is the whole idea of health multipliers. If you find the 3 to 4 things that would be most meaningful for you out of a list of only like 9 or 10, I would submit that you swing those three axes really well and hundreds of trees fall down. And you can just categorically move past these other things that you end up having to like manage all of the like minutia that are really just byproducts of missing optimizing the main things. And so.
In our last few minutes, and we've taken questions from the audience, but any questions from the crowd? We've covered a lot.
So you mentioned earlier about eating on the outside of the grocery store, basically eating to help people keep type stuff and limiting carbs. I guess my biggest question is also, people, I mean, years ago, Atkins started and then Mavericks down keto. What do you think about keto? Is it something that doing it a couple times a year or something? It helps like some resistance, things like that? Or do you just say, no, keto's not great, but maybe just limit carbs to X amount a day and not necessarily meat doses, but limiting the carbs will help? What are your thoughts on that?
All of those things. I would put keto in a similar bucket as a lot of other elimination diets, where you're effectively just eliminating one of the macronutrients. I mean, we only have three sources of energy, proteins, fats, or carbs. And as omnivores, we can eat any of them. There are elimination diets, whether it's veganism, vegetarianism, carnivorism. Keto is a slightly more open-minded, but it still largely eliminates carbohydrates. They all have the script for why they're beneficial short-term. Long-term, when you eliminate an entire category of nutritional resources, there's downside. And so what I would say is, I've messed with keto. I can't eat enough fat. And I eat too much protein. My preference is too much protein. I take myself out of ketosis by eating too much protein. It's strict in a way that I don't thrive in. I would say the biochemistry of it, it's killer. Like the science of it is awesome. But practically, it tends to be a hard thing to kind of walk out, as do a lot of the elimination diets. I think I see people who have been keto or carnivore or vegetarian long term, and they have a huge areas that they're being exposed to that they're not aware of as a consequence. So I would just say, depends on your goals. There's nothing inherently, there's nothing bad or evil about it. It is what it is, and it has benefits and it has downsides, and it may work for you. It depends on your preference and it depends on what your goals are.
Patrick.
What do you think of fasting and thinking of fasting as a consistent habit fasting, such as once a week or once a month, or you make it a habitual scenario as part of your nutrition diet plan?
I could have used this as what I no longer a change in my belief system. Mm-hmm. I have recently cooled off on long fasting. I for probably 4 or 5 years, I was really big on 3-5 day water fast kind of things as a regular part of one's. And I'm not anti, but I'm a little quiet on that now because I'm not sure. I think that most humans would benefit from some sort of intermittent fasted lifestyle as a foundation of the way they eat, defined as there's at least 12 hours in every 24 that you're not eating, and you don't go longer than 24 hours without eating. Like that 12 to 24 hours, I would call an intermittent fast. And I would say, on average, most people would benefit from like tightening up the hours they actually consume. And if they didn't change what they ate, they just changed the when they ate. If they put the religion on the when and not the what, they would probably benefit. Especially if you have any excess weight or metabolic disease. I mean, quickest way to stabilize your blood sugar is don't eat. And then you have to use free glucose that's available. And then if you layer in things like fasted workouts, so like you go into your workout fasted, yeah, but I don't perform as well. Well, I know. Is this about performance or is it about like, depends on the goals. If you're a power lifter or you're an athlete, don't fast. Bad. NFL guys do not fast. They're eating all the time. And if they don't adjust their diet when they retire, you see what happens to them.
Two more very quick questions, Fahad.
I've noticed there are more people in my orbit giving up alcohol altogether. Something I think about often. I don't know if I have the courage to speak. I'm going to step one word, shut you down. What's your take on how that plays its own words?
I'm so glad you brought this up. I consume alcohol. So I'm not coming from a place of like judgment. If you consume alcohol on a regular basis and you are not where you want to be health-wise, this is a general statement, I would encourage people to audit their alcohol intake because you're likely underestimating its impact in your journey. And it's not about the empty calories, although empty calories are a thing. And it's not just about the empty calories with the sugary mixers if you're doing cocktails, which is a thing. Or the craft beers that are like basically a metabolic disease dumpster fire. But it's the loss of executive function, decision-making, the way you eat when you drink, its impact on the sleep cycle. It's very seductive because it helps initiate sleep, but it's devastating to staying asleep. And those are different physiologies. And so if it's creating friction in you, there's probably something there. And what I would say is, what I've seen work with my members is, hey, 50% reduction, either in terms of days a week that you consume or volume you drink when you do. For me personally, I never drink more than 4 days a week. And I never have more than two drinks, ever. There's no exception. And I'm very disciplined on that. And I needed that kind of framework, like the rules. I'm an athlete, as an army, like I need rules. And that's really helped and it's worked for me. Just knowing I'm only gonna allow myself to do it so often. And when I do, and there's I don't negotiate with myself.
Last question, all the way in the back.
Yes, along the lines of pharmacology, GLP stuff, what out there are you hearing or are you exposed to other incredible wonder circumstances that are in the pipeline?
What's next is going to be iterations of that. I think it's quite literally the gateway drug into a whole new class of gut hormone type pharmacology, which no one asked, which I'm grateful because I don't have a good answer about gut health. It is probably gut and brain. I mean, we know like tons about this much. I mean, stay tuned with gut. But GLP-1 agonist, it's a gut hormone. It's part of the neurohormonal environment that communicates between our brain, our gut, our liver. And this is so powerful because these are all connected. Because I don't know if you know this, but people eat not just because they're hungry. But we eat when we're happy and we're sad and we're bored. And so that's why this drug is so powerful. I have friends and colleagues in addiction centers that are using GLP-1s during the recovery process for craving control. It's profound what it's doing to the pleasure center. It's just turning it off. It's creating space to create new behaviors and new patterns. I think that it will be other gut hormone-like pharmacology that potentially could create some big breakthroughs. But I'll be honest with you, I wouldn't worry about too much about what's coming down the pike because what's here is already enough to change most people's lives if you have that particular struggle.
So we'll stay up here for a bit, but first off, I want to thank you. You've been a tremendous friend to our firm for a while. You're down there in Nashville. We've got your QR code up here. We know you're in Nashville, but we are going to have a follow-up with some folks who do something similar here in Dallas. That you've suggested, but thank you to all of you for coming and taking time out of a busy Thursday. I know everybody's got a lot going on, but this is always one of the top priorities of our life. And look, I go back to what I said earlier is why do we host an event like this? Because it matters. Because this is an intellectually curious organization. It goes well beyond wealth. If my clients want to live to 95, I got to make sure that they got the money to get there. But if you are new to the conversation, If you are one of our clients, first, thank you. But if you're new to the conversation, engage with us, because these are the type of conversations that we're going to have. And they're not always comfortable, but they're always purposeful and they're always intentional. So with that, I want to thank you all for your time. We're going to be up here for a little bit, and we'll follow up with you in the coming days with some follow-up what we discussed. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you so much for your attention. It's the most valuable thing you could ever offer me, and I don't take it for granted. You can find out more about today's episode and all of the other resources we have at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all the other content we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has ever provided you with value, it would mean the absolute world to me if you subscribed to our show and left a review. This helps us ensure more people just like you can find our content so they can begin their journey of optimizing health. To learn more about the concierge services we provide our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. And now for the obligatory disclaimer. This podcast is for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or the giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should seek the advice of their own medical professional providers.